The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 231, Premium Edition, for Sunday, December 13th, 2009.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the inaugural Premium Edition of the Mac Geek Gab podcast. If you're here, you know why you're here, because you've already signed up, and we do appreciate your support. If you are here and you don't know why you're here, then I'll send you back to show 230 to hear all about this, because I can't imagine why you'd be here if you didn't know. But anyway, you're here. And John, you said that it is Sunday, December 13th, which of course is true at the moment, but I don't believe that this will be released into the wild until tomorrow morning, Monday, December 14th. Did I say July?
Oh,
but anyway, December 14th, only because I want to make sure I'm at my desk, and more importantly, that Steven's at his desk to make sure that everything is smooth. And if we do have any problems, we're right there to attend to the listeners' needs and the subscribers' needs, because we want to make sure this is a smooth thing. So I think with that, we just dive right in and do what we know how to do here, John. Sound good?
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yes.
So we will start with Stefan's question, and I hope I have the audio in the right order.
Hi, John. Hi, Dave. This is Stefan from Hamburg, Germany. I got a question concerning scheduled Time Machine backups. I got a Mac Mini hooked up to my flat screen TV, and I'd like to backup it via scheduled Time Machine backups. I know you can get nice schedules with a Time Machine editor. Unfortunately, the Mac, when it's asleep, doesn't wake up for those scheduled times. Have you got any idea how to trigger a wake-up of the Mac Mini? Thanks, and have a nice day. Bye.
Thanks, Stefan. John, you got this one.
Absolutely, there is. Now, right. I think this will address part of the issue, but at least as a start. So the question being, is there a way to tell the machine to wake up? And the answer is yes. You go into System Preferences, Energy Saver, you're going to see a schedule dot, dot, dot button. You click on that, and, oh, no, you know, I think I do see a way. Okay, I didn't think this would do it. I think it will. So there are two selections here, Startup or Wake.
Right.
So if you click on that button, now here, okay. I got to think of it. But anyway, so you can specify every day, weekdays, weekends, Monday, Tuesday. So it looks like you can either pick a day of the week, every day, or just weekends or weekdays.
Right.
And you can select a time to wake up.
And, you know, okay, so the limitation there, John, would be that you can't have it wake up multiple times throughout the day.
No, and when I was looking at the menu, I thought maybe there'd be a way to make it more complex. There doesn't appear to be a way to make it.
No.
I thought it'd be nice if it had it, you know, like every, I was hoping for a selection like every X hours.
Oh.
And, you know, I got to poke around, because I just got to feel that if it can do this once, it can do it multiple times. Maybe not through the Apple interface, though.
Right. Right. Yeah, I would agree with you. There's got to be a way. But, you know, for backups, I think once a day would be enough. You know, I mean, how much more do you need? And then, as Stefan mentioned, with Time Machine Editor, which is a great third-party app, I know I use it on my Macs, and I think you do too, John, is that you go in and you can set when you want that backup to start, and you can also tell it, you know, start as soon as the computer wakes up. So you can go in and set it. What I would do is set it to backup, you know, maybe 3 or 4 minutes after you have it wake up, just so that the computer can wake up and you're sure that it's awake, and then have the backup fire off. And that should get it going. I think that would do it.
You know, I had another thought as we were talking about this.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a stab here, is that I'm looking in Time Machine Editor, and they have an option here, backup when computer wakes from sleep.
Yes.
I know there's a way. I don't know if you see where I'm going here, but just a thought is that some Macs you can wake up if they are connected to a wired, and
yes,
I'm not sure about wireless, but on a wired network, and that's in a different place. So I'm wondering if one thing to consider is to have another machine over the network use the wake on LAN feature
yes.
that I think is in most recent Macs. That could be another way. It's kind of hokey. I just thought of it, and it just came to my mind because I looked at Time Machine Editor and see that that's something that they take into account. So,
yeah, that's right.
So maybe you can prod it from afar and say, okay, wake up.
Yeah, well, that would give you the flexibility because you could certainly write an Apple script on a remote Mac that sent that magic wake on LAN packet. And all Macs will wake on LAN over Ethernet. Newer Macs, I think Macs released in about the last 6 months or so, will wake over airport as well. They have the capacity to do that. But you know, you could do an Apple script and time it and, you know, whatever you wanted. Of course, the problem is if that other Mac is asleep, then it's not going to send the packet and your Mac Mini is not going to wake up. So, you know, you got to figure out what the most important thing is. You know, if backing up once a day is enough, you've got the solution right in front of you. If it's not, then you either we got to find a solution. If any of you out there know, please tell us if there's another interface for this. But otherwise, then you could head down the path of creating an Apple script on a second Mac. And yeah, that's right. Time to move on to Paul, John?
Yes.
Okay. Paul says, just bought a 27-inch iMac. Everything is fine, but I have one issue. When I start up or shut down, there's a bunch of commands, text, that scrolls on the left side of the screen. I own three other Macs and have never seen this. Is there a way to remove it from the startup and shut down? Okay. So what's happening is...
What is it, first of all?
Yeah. It's what they call verbose mode. When your Mac starts up, as we all know, or many of us know, the Mac runs Unix under the hood, okay? And when Unix starts up, there's a whole laundry list of stuff that just, you know, it just starts regurgitating all this status as it, you know, pulls the video card online and the hard drives online and mounts everything the right way and finds all the hardware and then goes and starts loading, you know, the operating system and all that. And then finally, the graphical interface comes up. Apple, in their infinite wisdom, decided to hide this by default because no one wants to see it and it can get confusing, as Paul has written. The answer is they put the little gray screen over it with the Apple and the little spinning deal. So you can see it if you want. And the way you do it is you hold down Command V at startup and then it will make the gray screen go away and you'll see all this gobbledygook come. And it can be helpful from diagnostic purposes, right? If you start up in verbose mode, and that's what that command V is for, then when you shut down, it will also shut down in verbose mode. It's sort of one and the same. But Paul's probably sitting here saying, but hey, guys, I don't hold down command V on startup, and I'll swear that there's nothing wrong with my keyboard that's causing this to happen. And there's a Knowledge Base article about this. But it sounds like you're in permanent verbose mode. And there is a couple of articles that we will point to that talk about how to always boot your Mac in verbose mode. And there's some NVRAM settings you can change that will set and unset that. So I think that's the magic answer. You got anything to add there, John?
I'm wondering if something in the past, if a utility has mucked about with one of the startup scripts and
could
this
be
is enabled.
Yeah.
I'll have to look around for that to see how you if you did want this to happen, how you would go about doing it.
Yeah, I'm looking here. It's in the terminal, you set sudo space nvram space boot dash args args equals quote dash v quote. And that will turn on verbose mode. And to turn it off, it's the same command, but nothing after the equal sign, and then it wipes out all the boot arguments. And in theory, that should do it. When you type this command, because it has sudo, sudo in front of it, it will ask you for your password. And that's just to authenticate you to make sure that you can make sweeping system-wide changes to your Mac. Is that bad?
Well, no, there's a good reason they asked for the password, because as you imply, sweeping system-wide changes have the potential for disaster.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Let's go to Doug. We'll come back to Kevin and Jason later. So let's go to Doug. He's got an interesting issue here. Doug writes, I have a problem that's reared its head over the past month. While troubleshooting a network address problem relating to Snow Leopard upgrade, I removed my Linksys BEFSRV41 version 2 router connecting my iMac and cable modem directly. As an afterthought, I use speedtest.net to check my upload and download speeds. With no router in the loop, it reported I was getting 17 to 21 megabits per second down and almost 1 megabit per second up. With the router reconnected, it reported only 6 to 7 megabits per second down and still about 1 megabit per second up. I got this router in 2002 and have upgraded the firmware last in 2004. That's the latest available. I thought routers weren't supposed to slow down the throughput. Do you think this router is just too old? If so, what wired router would you suggest? I hesitate replacing it if I'm going to have the same problems with the new one. In reality, without the router, I would only have noticed significant increases in downloads, but most day-to-day internet traffic hasn't appeared to change much. Okay. So I started thinking about this, and John, I actually prepped this question in the air, so I couldn't look up the specs of the router because we had no GoGo in-flight wireless on my flight back from Austin on Friday. But it hit me. It's like, wait a minute. You know, what if his router only supports 10 megabits per second throughput? What if it's only a 10 base T Ethernet port on the port on the router that goes to the cable modem? If that was the case, he certainly wouldn't get more than 10 and might even see 6 to 7, depending on, you know, various circumstances. So we sent an email off to Doug and said, okay, you know, that could be the issue. Go ahead and plug your iMac in to the port on the router that the cable modem would go into, and then check the network speeds. And I told him a convoluted way to see the network speed in the terminal. But John, you found a much better way, so I'll let you take it from there.
I found a couple of things. So I'll tell you the first thing I found. So the better way. So, you know, we all love mucking about, you know, in the terminal.
Of course we do.
But not everybody wants to do that. Now, the nice thing is that Apple includes something, should be in your application folder, called Network
Monitor.
Hold on. Network Utility, I'm sorry.
Oh.
And Network Utility is basically a pretty interface over this stuff that you're going to get anyways. And so if you go into Network Utility, it should default to an info tab. And then below that is the different network interfaces that you have. And for example, I'm looking here. EN0, which is typically your first Ethernet port, and mine says link speed, 1 gigabit.
That's a good thing.
Yes. Oh, that's very good, because that's what it's supposed to be.
Right, right.
Because that's what my Time Machine has as well. So that's a place to look to see at least what the computer thinks the link speed should be.
And Macs are pretty good at auto sensing. I've of all the computers out there that I've used with auto sensing, Macs seem to be the most reliable. So, you know, I usually trust what it finds. Yeah.
Well, I see where you're going, and actually, maybe so one piece of data, though, I was searching for that particular model number while you were talking. That device does seem to be a 10/100.
Hmm. But is it 10/100 on the internal switch, the switch that's going to let your network talk? And only a 10 base T connection to your cable modem.
All I know is I'm looking in the specs here, and it says equipped with a 3 or 4 port 10/100 switch.
Yeah, see, so that's the switch for your internal network. I would bet that the port to the cable modem is only a 10 base T port.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
the device on the cable modem. Yes,
yeah, not on the cable modem, because clearly the cable modem can talk faster than 10 base T because he plugs his iMac into the cable modem and it's fine. But the trick would be plug the iMac into not the port that you'd normally plug it into on the router, but the port that the cable modem would plug into on the router.
Right.
Right. Because I think that's the limited one. I've seen this. I've had routers where, you know, yeah, it's got a 100 megabit switch for your network, but they chintzed out and they put a, you know, older 10 megabit port because they figure, well, what cable modem's going to go faster than 10 megabits, you know?
Right, right. So you're talking the WAN, what we'd call the WAN port.
Bingo. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's what it's usually called, is the WAN, the WAN port. That's right. Yeah.
And actually, it's even marked on here. And you know what? This device does, I'll poke around a bit more, but it doesn't explicitly say the WAN port is 100. It could very well, for cost savings, be 10.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the device on your local network, you can communicate at 100. So.
Yep. But that's what I do, is I plug it in and check it there. There is another place to check it, though, John. Did you notice that, too? Oh.
Where?
All right. Go into your network system preference pane. Highlight your Ethernet connection once it's plugged into that WAN port. Again, you're not going to get any data passing back and forth because it's not built for that in this sense. But once it's connected, highlight the Ethernet port in the network system preference pane. Click on advanced. Go all the way out to the end and choose Ethernet. And make sure it's set to configure automatically. And then see, you'll have three grayed out drop-down menus below. They're grayed out because you've set it to configure automatically, but they're going to show you what it's set to and set to check to see the speed. Now it's going to be in terms of base T. So you're either going to see 100 base T or 1000 base T or 10 base T. And it's that 10 base T that will tell you, it's talking at 10 megabits a second. That's not going to be fast enough for my cable modem connection.
And I found it.
Go.
In the FAQ, they have a question. Does the WAN connection of the, and this is a funny answer, actually. Does the WAN connection of the cable DSL router support 100 megabits per second Ethernet? And the answer is, since broadband internet connections like cable and DSL do not exceed 10 megabits per second, the cable DSL router's current hardware only supports 10, which is kind of funny. Because
bingo!
That is certainly not the case in this day and age, but when this device was made, I think that was a perfectly valid statement.
So even though I was really high, I got the answer right. Is that
how
what we're saying?
Are you?
29,000 feet.
Only 29?
Yeah, we flew low, but you know what? It was because there was some turbulence, but flying that low, man, we got back in less than 3 hours, Dallas to Boston. It was awesome. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess really high. I was pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah, they answer the question in here. Again, it's a reasonable assumption when this device was made.
Right.
Because, I'm seeing what is
30.
Optimum Online here. They actually, I think, offer, it's like Opt Online Ultra.
Yeah.
Which I think exceeds 100 megabits. I think it just goes over that.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, you pay for it.
Yeah.
It's not fiber, but it's a.
Yeah, I can get 50 here. I had it for a day just to check it out, and it was like, this is stupid. I mean, it was fast. Don't get me wrong. And having 10 megabit upstream was actually pretty cool. But anyway. So as far as what router to get, what wired router to get, man, I don't know. They're all different, but these days they're all going to support 100 megabits on the WAN port. So, I'm a wireless router kind of guy because that's what I always wind up getting. And I like the Linksys ones. I always go because, I like to run that crazy DDWRT firmware. Mm-hmm. I always go to the there's a page on Linksys, on the DDWRT site that will let you put in a router number and it'll tell you if the firmware is going to work on that. It's their supported hardware lookup router database. So that's where I always check after I, look around, but I don't know of a good wireless router. Of a good wired only router, off the top of my head. So,
I'm a big fan right now. I've been using for quite a while and I really like the, time capsule.
Oh yeah. There you go. Yeah.
As
of course that's wireless
it's
too.
Gigabit. It's gigabit. And,
and really expensive because it's got a hard drive in it.
Yeah, it's not as expensive as I would have thought for having a. I think this one I got has a terabyte,
right,
in it. But yes, I just found this Opt Online Ultra 101 megabits downstream.
Wow,
15 up.
That's crazy, dude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you gotta watch your cable lines will heat up, melt. All right. Moving on. But yeah, just for Doug. Go to, I don't know. I really don't know of which wired router to get. I have an answer for you. But any of them that you pick are going to have 100 megabit connections, or at least make sure they do. But I can't imagine they'd sell anything today that didn't, because all cable modems are going to go faster than that now, or at least possibly go faster than that. All right. Jamie wrote a couple of things. And he actually sent an email with an audio comment. So we'll do both in succession. Firstly, please. Okay. The email comment. I'd like to add my take to the Magic Mouse discussion/debate. I both like and dislike this mouse. Unlike many people, I never liked the Mighty Mouse or any scroll wheel two-button mouse. I always preferred the Apple Mouse or Apple Pro Mouse, the oval single-button ones. When it comes to the Magic Mouse, however, I love the idea of multi-touch. It's great on the trackpad and iPhone. What I can't cope with is the fact that it's wireless only. It seems like the obvious answer to me would have been to incorporate either a dock or mini USB port to enable it to be used as a wired or wireless mouse. If they were to do this, you may even be able to incorporate a rechargeable battery. If they'd done this, I'd have bought one instantly, even at a higher price. Any thoughts? Okay, so I do like the idea of charging it in a little dock or something like that. However, you know, now you're building a battery charger into the mouse, and you know, maybe Apple didn't want to head down that path of forcing people to do that, or the tech support nightmare that comes when people put alkaline batteries in and then start charging them and then they don't work quite right. Even though I've charged alkaline batteries for years and, you know, it sort of works. Just got to make sure you don't blow them up. But the real deal for me, John, on mice is that I really don't like wired mice in general. They can be more accurate and there's times where that's actually very valuable. But what I find is ergonomically, a wired mouse is probably the worst thing for me because I'm always kind of fighting against where that cord is going. And yeah. And the cord's sort of, you know, giving me resistance where with a wireless mouse, I wouldn't have it. And I find actually if I use a wired mouse for any significant period of time, my wrist winds up hurting because I'm, you know, applying extra pressure, you know. Yeah, yeah. I actually notice it. So
now I've seen actually vendors make I think at one point a vendor made kind of mouse pad, but also it was kind of like a virtual person to basically stand there and hold the cord up so it doesn't get in your way. I know yeah. I've seen somebody do this. I don't know if it was Kensington or
yeah,
or
like on the mouse
point.
Pad, like a little goal post almost that had yeah. the yeah yeah
it
yeah
keeps the cord out of the way. Now yeah. you know, I'm wondering if the Magic Mouse has USB in it, and if you wanted to break out the drill and void your warranty and all that, that you could get in there. If it even has the capability to communicate using USB.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh.
I'll have to find one and rip it apart.
Yeah.
The other thing that occurs to me is that, you know, you and I have both seen this, Dave. Like, for example, I have a electric toothbrush.
Yeah.
And that has what I've seen, not in a lot of appliances, but, you know, it's not unheard of. I guess it does it through induction or something. But basically, you know, there's no wires, but the device charges.
Right.
Being put in a special base. And I'm wondering, that would be, I think, kind of an elegant.
Logitech does that.
They do. Oh, they yeah. do have one. Okay.
Yeah.
I figured yeah. somebody would come up with that. That could be a nice, you know, suggestion for Apple to think about something like
you
that.
You know, it'd be cool is if they put like a microwave transmitter in like the corner of the iMac
no,
or
no,
something.
No, no,
and
no,
you could
no.
aim it down at the mouse and beam the power right at it. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
I've actually seen some of these wireless power systems at it was a visit I made up to MIT a while ago.
Uh-huh.
Those are fine as long as nothing gets between yeah. the transmitter and receiver, because humans yeah. don't react to microwaves very well.
No, it tends to cause cancer among burns and other things like that.
No, just cooking you.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that's our thoughts on that. I'm not sure what you think about that, Jamie, but there we go. Okay, and then your friend's PowerBook. Here we go.
Hi, John. Hi, Dave. Hi, Pete. I have a problem with a PowerBook G4 17-inch 1.5 gigahertz machine that belongs to a friend of mine. The hard drive recently died. I replaced this for him last weekend, reinstalled Leopard, did all the necessary updates to bring it up to 10.5.8. Everything is fine. He has since returned to Turkey, where he lives, and now he's unable to receive internet at his address. There are Microsoft laptops in the house which do access the internet. His airport appears to be connected to their network from what he describes to me on the phone. The bizarre thing is that he was able to get internet both at my house when I made the repairs and also at the guest house address down the road from where he lives. I'm left scratching my head on this one a bit. The only thing I could think of was that possibly on their router there was a list of allowed devices, but as far as I'm aware, this is usually done by MAC address, and that shouldn't change with a new hard drive, should it? any ideas you've got on this would be greatly appreciated.
All right, well, we'll stop it there. Yeah, it's true, unless you changed the motherboard, which you were pretty clear about what you did, that you did not change the motherboard, and that would be the only way to change the hardware MAC address. However, there is a way to set the MAC address in software from the command line. Now, I've always assumed that when you do that, it actually wrote to the hardware to do it, but perhaps it only changes it in the OS, and then the OS kind of, you know, on every reboot says, oh yeah, here's this plist file, go ahead and do it. I don't know the answer to that. That's possible. It seems like a stretch, and it also seems like your friend would probably have been aware of having changed the MAC address for that specific reason. You got any ideas, John?
It doesn't sound like the computer to me. I'm wondering if something else has changed. I mean, it's worked on, you know, both his and he indicated another location. It worked on both of those.
That's true.
You know, that's two data points right there. So,
here's what changes on the hard drive, on the, you know, that's stored on the hard drive is the MTU setting, right?
Well, if it's a fresh OS install.
A fresh OS install, it's going to be a flat, you know, standard MTU. And as we've seen, some routers don't like the MAC standard 1500 MTU setting. So perhaps lowering the MTU would solve this problem. And that is stored on the hard drive. So back to network system preference pane. Because Windows machines have a slightly lower default MTU than Macs do. So in the system preference pane, you go to, or in system, how you doing, John? Your throat fantastic. Holding up all right? Good. Excellent.
Got some water.
Good. Yep. So go into the network system preference pane. Click on your airport connection. Click on advanced. Now, this is going to seem counterintuitive, but go all the way over to the last tab, which is labeled Ethernet. And configure it manually. And the MTU is probably set to 1500. I would say set it down. Use custom and set it down to 1400 and see if that works. That might be the magic answer. That's the only thing I can think of. John?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a Leopard machine, too. I think it was mentioned. It's a PowerBook G4. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Leopard is as far as your.
Yeah, because Leopard's MTU options are standard at 1500, jumbo at 9000, and then custom where you can set it to whatever you want, anywhere from 72 to 9000. So I would go to 1400. If that doesn't work, go down to 1000. If that doesn't work, then this probably isn't the issue. And we got to kind of go back to the drawing board. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else to add there, John?
No, I think we need some more data.
But, okay.
You know, try some of the things we mentioned.
And write us back. Let us know. We've got some good tips, John. Let's head into the tips section here. The first one was from Dave Mara, who's actually, I think he's in K-12 sales at Apple. He tweets as Marathon, M-A-R-R-A-T-H-O-N, and does actually share some cool Mac tips from time to time via his Twitter account. In the Finder, he says, click on an item and do Command T to add it to your Finder's sidebar. To add it to the dock instead, do Shift Command T. That's actually pretty cool. I never used either one of those. So, you got anything, John? No.
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
All right, go.
Surprise. So, you may be asking yourself, Dave, where would I go if I wanted to find out about all these keyboard shortcuts?
Would I go if I wanted to find out about all these keyboard shortcuts?
What are you asking me for? No. go to the Finder, go to Help, and then you're going to see a search field. And you know, if you type in keyboard shortcut, you'll see a few matches here. And I think the one that's most applicable here is about keyboard and other shortcuts. If you open that up, it has a list that's very nicely organized into shortcuts for system basics, shortcuts for system features, for files and folders, for application features. And I bet you that's buried in there somewhere.
All right, so here's something interesting. You're on a Snow Leopard machine, John?
No, that's on my Leopard machine, and I brought it up on Snow Leopard. It was a slightly different article name, but I thought I used keyboard shortcut or shortcuts as the search term.
Okay. Can you go to your, can you go to the Finder on your Snow Leopard machine for me?
Yes.
Okay. And then highlight some document or folder in the Finder there, either in the desktop or whatever. And then from go open up the file menu. Now, somewhere in the file menu, you will see that Command T is mapped to add to sidebar, correct?
Yeah, look at that.
Okay, now, while that's still open, hold down the shift key. On my Leopard machine, it changes from add to sidebar to add to favorites. What's it do for you?
On Snow Leopard, it says add to dock.
Aha! So this is a Snow Leopard tip. Now, I'm not sure what add to favorites is going to do for me here.
Oh, well, no, on Snow Leopard, if I hold down control,
yeah,
it says add to favorites. If I hold down shift, add to dock.
But what is favorites? Where's favorites? I mean,
where's favorites?
Yeah.
It's actually, it's not. Where is it? I thought it showed up in places. Actually, I think I have a default where it doesn't, but I think it's just a folder buried in your documents somewhere. Let's see.
I've never.
Hmm.
I find documents. I don't see favorites. Now, is it the kind of thing where if I'm like in Safari and I go to choose open, do I have like a favorites list? No. I didn't mean to head us down a path where we were lost like this, but I add to favorites. I mean, I chose it. Nothing happened.
I've seen it here. No, there's a favorites folder. I'm looking at default folder right now.
Okay.
Default folder, if you use that.
I don't have that on this machine.
Okay. But here, for example, so there must be. Yeah. So we got to figure another way to get to this because, well, no. Let me do this. So basically it shows a little heart here and it says favorites folder.
And how do you get there?
That's the thing. I'm clicking on it. I don't see the path to it. Okay, this is a mystery we're going to have to solve a little later here. Exactly where favorites.
Okay, so I'm reading a knowledge base article here. You can add items to your favorites folder for quick access. In the Finder, you can add aliases, folders, blah, blah, blah. Select an item, choose add to favorites from the file menu. You can also click add to favorites when you save or open a file in an application. To open a favorite, click the favorites button in a Finder window toolbar. Aha. So if we go to the view menu and customize toolbar in the Finder, do I have a favorites? Nope. See, I thought I might be able to come out here and see like a favorites thing, you know, to add to the toolbar there in the Finder. I got nothing.
No, I see it.
Where? How am I missing this, John?
No, I think I found it here.
Okay.
No, I found a dialog in Safari here, and favorites is listed in places. So on the bar on the left in the file dialog, which I think also pretty much matches the Finder, but I have something called favorites. If I click on favorites, favorites is actually, let's see the path to it here.
Yeah.
John Braun Library Favorites.
Aha. That's
a weird place to put. Okay, yeah. So look in your local library folder, and you should have a favorites folder.
And there it
in
is, that, the thing I just added today. Yep.
And then here I see network shortcuts to network documents and downloads as well. So that's where the favorites are.
Okay, so if you don't have it in your places list in the Finder, that favorites section is in your home folder in library, and it's named aptly favorites. Awesome. That was a worthwhile tangent, I think. That's good. That's good. That's good. All right. And thanks, Dave Mara, for heading us down that path. If you ever get a chance to see Dave Mara speak, he speaks at user groups all over the place. He is a very energetic, very entertaining, and very informative speaker. So he's a good guy to hunt down there. So, all right. Thomas actually helps us... corrects us and offers a solution.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Thomas from Mac SST. Just following up a little bit on your discussion of partitioning schemes and booting both Intel and PowerPCs from the same disk. You're correct that you can boot PowerPC and Intel machines from a disk that's Apple partition mapped. But if your listeners are going to do that, they have to be careful because or remember that if you have an Intel machine and you're installing the OS from the DVD onto the hard disk, it will not let you install onto an Apple partition map. It will say this disk must be partitioned as GUID. Now, you can get around that by installing onto a GUID disk and then cloning that GUID disk to an Apple partition map disk, and then that Apple partition map disk will be able to boot both Intel and PowerPC machines. But the install DVD on an Intel machine will not let you install directly onto an Apple partition map disk.
Interesting.
So that's just a little caveat to your discussion. Thanks very much for the show, guys.
Huh. I guess they're gently discouraging people from using legacy partition schemes.
Yeah. That's a cool way of getting it there, because it is handy to have, you know, certainly pre Snow Leopard anyway, handy to have a disk that can boot multiple flavors of Macintosh, right? After Snow Leopard, it doesn't matter, because you can't boot a PowerPC with Snow Leopard anyway. So cool. We had an interesting discussion back and forth. It was sort of I was going to say offline, but it was very much an online discussion. It was just off air discussion back and forth with Kirk about some weird issues that his cousin was having with an aluminum MacBook, not a MacBook Pro, but an aluminum MacBook. And he says, and this is sort of a word of warning out there, the reason for my cousin's aluminum MacBook problems with Snow Leopard is that his machine was so rare that the engineers, you're supposed to ask, how rare was it?
How rare was it?
That's right. It was so rare that the engineers didn't really have it at the front of their mind when designing 10.6.2. He's been talking on the phone with some higher-ups at Apple who will probably be swapping it out with a 13-inch MacBook Pro. The OS was corrupting files on his machine left and right, somehow due to the bus and SATA stuff that was only a part of the briefly manufactured aluminum MacBooks. My white MacBook hasn't seen any of these problems. Just thought I'd let you know to share it with your listeners. All right. Thank you, Kirk. That's very interesting. So if you're a MacBook, aluminum MacBook user running 10.6.2, be careful, because Kirk, at least via his cousin, has seen some significant issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have significant issues?
Yeah, you know, I got a little cold here. It's fine. Plus, this is our second podcast in a row, and
you're all caffeinated up too.
Yeah, well, I had 4 hours of sleep and I had a gig last night, so it's like, yeah.
All right. To me, that just seems weird. But
it does. Yeah.
But then again, some have commented that sometimes various versions of OS X appear to have not been thoroughly tested on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And that the users are doing that.
All right.
Like Microsoft, right?
What's that? Okay, moving on to let's do Jason here. I think this audio is going to work. I think.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Jason in Houston. I have an early 2008 iMac 24-inch with a 320 gigabyte hard drive and 2 years left on my warranty. Trouble is I'm running out of disk space with only about 17 gig to spare and shrinking. I know that sounds like a lot, but you can appreciate what a movie or two will do, or even a few video podcasts. So I'm looking for your help on a proper solution, and I thought of you guys. So I'm thinking if I replace the drive, that might void the warranty. And I'm relatively new to iMacs, so to the Mac. Ideally, I was thinking I would slide a solid-state drive in and use the current one as an external enclosure, in an external enclosure for my data. But my second option would be to use an external drive as my boot device. But that begs the question of what to do with the internal drive, of course. What would you recommend I consider as a next best option, given a relatively low budget and a desire to keep my warranty happy? If I go external, will I be better served using available FireWire 800 And on another note, should I expect degraded performance if I use an external bootable drive versus the internal? And any other factors or considerations would certainly be appreciated. Thanks, guys. Here's where you cut me off.
All right. So first things first, I know that the G5 iMacs had do-it-yourself, user-serviceable, Apple-blessed procedures to replace the hard drive. However... Oh.
Do they have like a little door or something?
It was pretty easy. It was the to do it, you had to put the iMac face down. So, you know, you put a towel on the table, mm-hmm. face down, unscrew, I think, just two screws at the bottom, and then lift the whole back case off. And that's also how you replaced RAM inside it. And the hard drive was right there. So it was very easily accessible. On this new one, though, RAM is a door in the bottom of the iMac, which is even easier. However, from what I've been told, in order to replace the hard drive, you actually, I think this sounds crazy, but I think you even have to take the screen off. So, yeah, with that, it is not considered a user serviceable part. Apple's policies about it are that it voids your warranty if you break something going in or out to, you know, to replace this drive. So it's subjective. Depends on where you go, depends on who you talk to, and depends on how much they like the story that you're telling them. So, yes, you definitely risk voiding your warranty if you do this. You know, and if you do it and you don't have any problems and then you need to send it in for other warranty work, well, your best bet is to take out the drive that you've put in and put in your old drive so that Apple sees, you know, a happy to go, because they may decide to replace the drive while they're in there. They reserve that right anytime you send a machine in. So, you know, it's a big fiasco. I wouldn't recommend it if you're worried about that, right?
Yeah, now the place you can check, I'll just make a mention here, Dave.
Yeah.
www.apple.com/support/OSS is what I found.
Okay.
Just doing a quick search here, and then that goes to, on the right side of that page is something called Part Installation manuals.
Oh.
And if you go there, you can then search through all of the products where Apple says it's okay. So in his case, I think you got it. Is that this is, you know, Apple a lot of times oscillates between it being very easy and very hard to replace certain parts depending on how pretty they want the case to look or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
But in this case, you could look, like, for example, I found if I restricted the search on this particular page here to iMac, it even has here iMac G5 20-inch hard drive replacement instructions.
Sure.
So it's Apple sanctioned.
Yep.
Now I didn't look at the list here. We could look farther, but I'm sure we're not going to find. Yeah. It seems only the iMac G5 was one.
Right.
Where, you know, they want you to touch that.
Yeah.
Now to the question about external.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm with you. The one question was, you know, is it going to be limiting? And you know, FireWire 800, I think, is in theory not going to be reaching the maximum speed of the platter. So I don't think the interface, I don't think he would see any performance degradation, at least not big time.
No, I agree. And I think his best option in this case is to get an external full size, not a laptop size, you know, FireWire 800 drive, because there you will see degraded performance. Laptop drives, I don't care what the specs say on them. I don't care how fast they spin the stupid things. They are slow as molasses getting data to and from. Maybe seek times. I don't know what it is.
Well, yeah, they typically have either smaller caches or, slower rotational speed or just,
Even the 7200 RPM laptop drives I've had don't seem to me to make any difference in speed. So, in short, if you're going to use it as your boot drive, you have no reason to make it a portable drive, you know, it doesn't need to be bus powered or anything like that. Get a regular old, you know, full size hard drive. They're cheaper anyway. Run it on your FireWire 800 bus. I think you're going to be totally happy with that. And then you can use your internal drive for storage or backups or whatever you want. And as long as your iMac's not going anywhere, which they typically don't, they're not meant to be portable. You're not even going to care that you're running on an external drive. So, I think that's definitely the simplest way to go. It truly is plug and play. You just boom, you do it. You can even grab something like Super Duper and clone your existing drive over to it so that you don't have to reinstall unless you want to, because reinstalling can, you know, have its own benefits and all that good stuff. Right?
Yep.
You got anything to add there, John?
No.
Okay. So should we've got time here. We can do James, or we can go back and do John from 2:30. And I think that's the right way to go. I think that's right. The right way to go. It kind of fits in.
I got an answer
in
for James.
But, all right, then let's do James. Well, then maybe we'll do both. We'll see.
All possible answer.
Okay. That's good. Let me find James out here. James has been living with us for a while, this question. Okay, James writes, I have a question about compatibility of monitors of different resolutions. Currently, I have a 24-inch iMac set to the maximum resolution of 1920 by 1200 pixels. My second monitor is a large Hewlett-Packard, which is currently set at the resolution of 1050 by 1680 pixels. It can be set as high as 1344 by 10008. That doesn't seem to make sense because the other one is higher, but we'll go with this. If I move the Hewlett-Packard to another resolution, I get the message that the input signal is out of range and ask me to return it to the setting of 1050 by 1680. Now my question, I'm considering getting the 27-inch iMac, which has a maximum resolution of 2560 by 1440. My question is, am I going to be able to use a 27-inch screen with the Hewlett-Packard's second monitor without turning down the resolution of the 27-inch iMac? By the way, the Hewlett-Packard monitor is a W2207H. Is the HP monitor going to work with that much difference in resolution? Okay. So, John, go ahead.
I'm going to say, based on the information, so you want to get the specs on the machine in question. So what I did is I went to support.apple.com/specs.
Yep.
That's something that not everybody knows about, but that will give you the lowdown on the capabilities of each Mac. And in this case, I did find a line here, and it seems like, you know, it's just close, but not close enough. And I found a line in the specs that said, these iMacs will simultaneously support full native resolution on the built-in display and up to a 30-inch display, 2560 by 1600. Oh, so close.
Well,
in that he said the resolution.
Say that again. It'll support up to
2560 by 1600.
Okay, so the specs on his monitor are the maximum resolution of 1680 by 1050. So he's totally
I'm sorry. Oh, okay. He said 1050 by 1680.
You're right. So. Right, right. Yeah, I think it doesn't matter.
Oh, well, in that case, well, it does. Are you talking X or Y? Okay. Because here he reversed the numbers. So
right, right. But it wouldn't
matter. Okay, in that case, 1680 by 1050 certainly fits within 2560 by 1600.
Yep.
So based on what Apple says about the capabilities of the the chipset, the graphic chipset, and the external display,
good to go.
You should be fine.
Yeah, it's important to note to kind of explain why this is okay. The iMacs now, as well as the MacBook Pros and even the MacBooks, support two different types of external monitor configurations. One is what they call mirrored, where you set it so that both monitors use the same resolution and have exactly the same thing displayed on both. So if you have a window and your Finder toolbar and, you know, all that stuff on one, you're going to see it on the other. And it's just totally mirrored. Everything you do, if you move your mouse on one, it moves on the other. That's the mirrored configuration. And yes, both monitors need to be using the same resolution in some way, shape, or form. Then the other is display extension, where you've got one monitor and it uses its native resolution, and then you have another monitor and it uses its own native resolution, and they don't mirror each other. You can drag a window or your mouse or whatever you want from one monitor to the other, and it's as though it's one big virtual display. In that case, the resolution of one does not necessarily impact the resolution of the other. The only limitation, as John, you just pointed out, is that the machine itself, the graphics hardware, can only support up to a maximum resolution. And in this case, looks like James is going to be just fine. So it's actually pretty cool. If you've never done this before, Once you set it up, you put your second monitor in, you go to system preferences and you go to displays. And then in there, you'll actually see a third little tab pop up in between display and color, and it's called arrangement. And on that tab, you literally, with your mouse, drag the displays around. It's going to show you however many displays you get, 2, 3 or whatever. You drag them around to match your physical setup so that as you drag Windows or your mouse between the two, it's a seamless transition. And depending on the dot pitch of the display, it might not be totally seamless. You know, you might have some acceleration or whatever as you move it. But for the most part, you can set it up. And also there, you can drag and put which monitor you want to house your menu bar, because that will only appear on one. So your menu bar and your dock are always going to be on one monitor, but you get to pick which one that is. It's actually pretty cool. So, you got anything?
Yes. So I have a couple things.
Yeah,
so
good.
One,
go.
I'm just concerned because it seems that he reversed the resolution in his statement there when he said 1050 by 1680.
Yep.
As far as I'm concerned, convention dictates that the first number is the horizontal or X and the second number is the vertical or the Y.
Yep.
And typically the first one is going to be always larger. I think that's why I suspect that he misstated that it's not 1050 by 1680, it's 1680 by 1050.
Yeah, unless the monitor, it says that it will pivot, and this is important. Oh. So he can pivot the monitor, but as far as the Mac's concerned, it's the same. You would just go into the display section of the displays preference pane and set it that you've rotated the screen, 90 degrees, and then the Mac will reconfigure it. So it's all going to work just fine. But yeah, this is one of those displays that you can actually pivot the display itself and set it up either in, landscape or portrait mode to use.
Okay.
Those terms. Yeah.
Okay. So then that probably is a correct. You just got to make sure that, in the corresponding display panel, you get those numbers.
Yep.
In the right order. Otherwise, from what I saw before, it wouldn't quite fit. The other thing is that there's something which I haven't used for a while, but it's still out there, and it looks like they actually updated it for Intel and 64-bit. Is something called SwitchRes 10 or X, depending on how you want to say it.
I've heard of this, but I don't.
And this is something which I'll have to experiment with it more. I just installed it on the portable, and I want to play around with it a little bit more. This will let you get very intimate with the settings it'll show you all the permitted settings. Now, I do remember in the past, Apple would, if you held down a magic key, I tried it on my machine and I couldn't find it. Normally, it would show you what is called supported resolutions, which are resolutions that I think usually the monitor or the computer knows, there's this monitor, then I'm pretty sure these are the only resolutions you support, and I'm not going to show you any options that differ from that. SwitchRes 10, now, exercise caution here. I don't think it's as big of a deal now as it used to be. I mean, in the past, you could actually fry your monitor if you gave it settings, not so much resolution, but I think the frequency of the signal.
Right. Right.
So anyway, SwitchRes 10, if you want to try to create some additional modes that are not in the display control panel, SwitchRes 10, you can try it out and see if it does it for you. SwitchRes 10 is one tool that I think will let you go beyond what Apple advertises as the official supported resolution.
Oh, this looks cool.
Be careful. Normally what I've seen with any modern LCD, if you send it a signal that either has an invalid resolution or a, refresh rate or whatever that's too, it'll just say that
not interested.
No.
Yeah, right.
I'm not even going to try to show you this because it's obviously not something I support.
Oh,
so I don't think you'll damage anything, at least with newer hardware.
Sure, sure. Ah, that's cool, man. That's a nice little find. I'd heard of that before, but I never had checked it out, so. And that brings us to the end. All right.
Really?
So, yeah, this ends our first premium edition. We did do two of these back-to-back. We did our number 230 and 231 back-to-back just because of timing and our schedules. Typically, though, that's not going to be the case. We're going to find another time during the week. I think, and John and I need to hash this out, but I think it's going to be every other Thursday morning is going to be our schedule for recording this one. Something. We'll figure it out. Whatever.
Yes, yeah. We will.
We've got holidays and all that coming up that's just going to screw everything up anyway in the next 2 months because we've got CES and then Macworld, and I'm doing this crazy trip to Miami for New Year's Eve. But
really?
Yeah, I'll tell you about it. It's crazy. We're going to see Fish.
All right.
We're going to go see him for 2 nights. But I figured we've got a 7 a.m. flight home on January 1st. Now, the show's not going to end until, you know, after 1 o'clock. There's no reason to have a hotel room for, like, the 3 hours that we would be there. So I think we're going to hang, like, at the Admiral's Club or something. But that doesn't open until 4:30 a.m., so we got to find some diner. If anybody in Miami knows of a good, safe diner for my wife and I to hang out between the show and the thing, that would be good. But anyway.
Just hang out at the airport, man.
Well, that's where we'll plan to go. But, you know, it'd be nice to go somewhere else because the airports are pretty dead at 3 a.m. Anyway, you probably have our contact info, but we'll go through it anyway. Feedback@macgeekgab.com is the email address to use to get in touch with John and I.
Dave, did you say feedback@macgeekgab.com?
Oh, my God, I did. I said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's one option. Of course, you can send attachments, audio, video, graphics, or otherwise. But, you know, if you're just hankering to use the telephone, you can call us. And, Dave, you would call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. Skype to Mac Geek Gab. And, of course, you know, feel free to leave us iTunes comments. There is no iTunes store feed for the premium show because they don't. They're not flexible that way, but you can leave it on the regular Mac Geek Gab one, and of course that everybody will see that, so that's even better. I think that's it. iPhone Alley. Michael Johnson does provide the AAC conversion for this one too, and you're downloading the show from Cashfly, CacheFly.com, and that's it. We're out of here. Ready to go?
Wow. Yeah, I got the. I think it's about freezing outside now. So
awesome.
Go out and do something.
I'm exhausted.
Yeah, well, we did too, back to back. So yeah. Thank you very much for supporting our
thank you so much.
Premium content.
And especially you. Don't get caught.
Maynard.